And people saying that the president is doing a good job when there's 500% inflation and deep depression and shortages of food and medicine. Why is that? Again, it's because there are a lot of people who still, first of all, there's millions of people who actually appreciate what the 10 years of progress that they had under Chavez. Secondly, they're afraid of what might happen to them if a right-wing government takes power in a coup. And so, that's why it's so important to have negotiations. That's why you need constitutional guarantees. Whoever loses the next presidential election doesn't face a government that controls all three branches of government and uses it to persecute them. I think those are the things that are going to have to happen.
We have to leave
it
there. I want to thank you both for being with us. Daniel Lansberg Rodriguez speaking to us from Chicago at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, and Mark Weisbrot, Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C. That does it for our show. Very happy birthday to Laura Gottesdiener.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Joe and Abe Talk Radio.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo, and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/FuzzyBoo.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film tomorrow on Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. The documentary Tomorrow sets out to showcase alternative and creative ways of viewing agriculture, economics, energy, and education. It offers constructive solutions to act on a local level to make a difference on a global level. Instead of showing all the worst that can happen, this documentary focuses on the people suggesting solutions and their actions. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Tomorrow, Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hey.
Hey.
I'm Abe, you're Joe.
I'm Joe.
It follows then by the transitive property of show introductions.
Yes, this is the I didn't Abe know there Joe. Was such a thing.
Oh, yeah, there's transitive and distributive property of show introductions.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's been a while since you took a math class. I understand
I know.
That.
I understand.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program, 90.7 FM on your radio dial. We've got a lot to talk about today.
What?
You may have heard this term kicked around. In the discourse, more so lately than in recent years, but more and more over the past decade or so, I would say, and that is the resistance.
Resistance.
Yeah, or resistance in English.
Yeah, right.
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 I don't know what that half Frenchified thing you just did was, but
don't worry about it. It's beyond your worry area. It's beyond your pay grade.
Yeah, I understand that. But you didn't quite say it in French. You kind of said it in this sort of half-assed English French.
No, that was from Sussex.
Franglais.
No, it was
yeah,
fresh.
But your R, you
it's
had an Fringlish. English R.
It's Fringlish.
Franglais.
A very famous language that The upper class in England actually used to speak French, you know.
Yes, after the Norman conquest.
Yes.
But that's another story.
Well, boy, I guess.
The resistance. What is it and why do we have it? That's what we're going to be talking about today. And more importantly, what should that resistance look like? How can it be effective? And how can it bring about the sort of large-scale change that we so desperately need in the world at this time?
Okay, and we should also tell people, in case they're just tuning in or don't know it, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. The number to call, 231-8187.
All right. We're also taking your written commentary. If you can't get through by phone, you can write into the Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe, or to the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Why do we need to resist? It's not too hard to see why. It's not. Everywhere you look, we see signs that the strains that global capitalism is putting on all of our systems, social, economic, political, and environmental, we see the signs of these strains everywhere we look. Everywhere we look, we see that the current arrangement, the way that the world is organized, the way that the world does business, the way that the world conducts itself politically is not sustainable. It isn't. It is not serving us, the people. It hasn't served us, we the people, for a long time now. Everywhere you look, you see the signs of these things. We're a little more than 150 years into the Industrial Revolution, and it's becoming increasingly clear to anybody with a pair of eyes and a pair of ears and a brain that industrial capitalism is an unsustainable model of as a world system. We are bumping up against the limits of a closed biosphere. We have seen over and over again in country after country and government after government the corrosive effect of money on the mechanics of politics. We have seen global capitalism replace colonialism in a de facto sort of way. You can say, argue quite credibly, I think, that the old style colonialism with flags and colonies and also all this sorts of thing has been replaced by simply economic colonialism, where a small number of powers exert disproportionate influences on the resources. I'm talking about labor and natural resources and capital in far-flung places.
Well, and I would want to add that a small number of very powerful people, largely men, control resources disproportionate to what could reasonably be expected.
Yes, you're absolutely correct about that. A small number of people, mostly men, overwhelmingly white men, control these resources.
Right.
This is a fact. Everywhere we look, we see that global capitalism, as it is currently constituted, is going to wreck us. It's going to wreck the biosphere. It's going to wreck what now passes for democracy. It is going to wreck the health and the lives and the living conditions of literally billions of people.
Well, that also begs a question. Is it possible to have a healthy biosphere, a healthy, a fair distribution of wealth and so on under a capitalist system at all?
That's a very good question. I don't think we know the answer to that.
Well,
Here's why. If capitalism is ultimately predicated on no more than resource extraction, if we reduce it to its irreducible parts, and that is about going in and cutting down trees and digging things out of the ground and wringing every last bit of cheap labor out of human bodies, then no. The answer to that question is no.
There are really two fundamental things there. I'm not disagreeing with you. You're right. But remember that capitalist system is really dependent on production, yes, but also on distribution and demand. Much of what we hear a lot these days, or really a lot, is ignoring the demand factor. And the demand factor, there are many elements to it, aside from cultural demand notions like everybody should have a giant television set and everybody should have air conditioning, blah, blah, blah. But beyond all that, there's the fact that labor costs have not kept up with the cost of living, which this system definitely drives up. There's a whole host of injustices, unfair and unequal distributions that are not warranted by the importance of labor itself. So we're really running into a bunch of problems all at once, and we've got a criminal as the President of the United States.
Yeah, there's that too, a criminal as the President of the United States.
Yeah, kind of weird.
So the question we're going to put to you today, and this is a conversational thread that has cropped up many times on the show in the recent past. Just a few weeks ago, we talked about the protests that were held here in Portland.
Right.
What should our resistance to this global phenomenon now, and I think it's important that we identify what we're pushing back on. It's not simply something that's isolated here in the United States.
No.
This is a worldwide effort, a worldwide system that needs to be fundamentally changed. So how do we make that happen?
Well, okay, well, we'll hear from a lot of people.
No. And your answer is, it sounded like that laugh was, no, we can't make that happen.
Oh, no.
There's nothing we can do.
No. I don't believe there's nothing we can do. I think that the current level of knowledge, particularly in the so-called democracies, and particularly in the United States, is incredibly low. I see many and hear many, many people who really don't seem to know, from the point of view that I have at least, what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still hearing from people who are claiming, well, look, Hillary was just as much a crook as Donald Trump. And there's this mythic Hillary. I'm just using an example here. I don't want to talk about the election. I just want to use the example. That somehow, with no real-world basis of evidence, that what happened in the election was maybe fair because Hillary was just as much a crook and did just as much manipulation as Donald Trump. And that is a purely ignorant notion. We are dealing with a system now which has, because of technologies, opened the possibility of incredible electoral fraud, on top of which we have a Congress which has forever now essentially created a system, really a system of gerrymandering, which locks in the power of a, I would call it a basically a right-wing ideology.
Yes, and we have a group of capitalists, and make no mistake, this is a group of capitalists who have managed to create on the right wing in the United States and in other Western countries a conversational, an echo chamber in which everyone's worst fears are reinforced and their worst anxieties reinforced. And I'm talking about things like Fox News and the right-wing media. There is a place where a sizable chunk of the American electorate can go and hear exactly what it wants to hear.
Regardless of their place in the spectrum of politics.
Right, and they have become, no, not regardless of their place in their spectrum of politics. I'm talking about people on the American right, the American political right.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right? I agree.
They can now, if they so choose, take in what they believe is news that tells them everything they want to hear, that reinforces their deepest fears and anxieties, and really has no resemblance to news, no bearing on reality whatsoever. And they have further been convinced that the difference between what they're hearing on Fox News and what they're hearing from Rush Limbaugh, that the difference between that and what the rest of the world perceives as reality is simply a difference of opinion. It's simply fake news.
Right.
This represents, in my mind, perhaps the greatest triumph of the global capitalist elite, the ability to literally shape reality in the minds of tens of millions of voters.
Well, you're getting into some very complex issues. What is the role of the global elite? There is, within the spectrum of that elite, a liberal force and a much more reactionary force. So we have to be aware of that as well. I am not trying to limit the importance of a change in the delivery of services and so on, which would involve some, even perhaps revolutionary changes in the way things are done. I'm just saying it's really far, far more difficult than one can imagine. And I am not wanting to get into what happened in Hamburg.
Oh, I do. I want to get into what
you
happened.
You want to get into it? We can get into it.
I think it bears directly on what we're talking about.
Okay, go ahead.
No, continue, please.
Well, one of the most important things about that was the incredible deep, I would say deep, frustration and rage, and I've talked about this in the context here, of people who, not all of them wear black, but who I would call, for lack of a better term, black bloc, masked up folk.
Antifa.
Yeah.
Anti-fascist.
Well, but I hate that term because I'm an anti-fascist, but I don't like to hurt people or burn things down.
No. I'm glad you mentioned that, because when we're talking about the shape of the resistance and what I believe it ought to look like, I don't think you can have that conversation without bringing up the Antifa.
No, I agree. Okay.
So let's do this. Let's take a call, and then we'll dive right into our discussion of what the resistance ought to be.
Okay.
All right. Who's Mike, good morning.
Good morning. I got to come up for air, guys. God almighty. That's a lot too late. I just wondered, without getting off topic real bad, would you care to at least give us a quick primer on what happened in Europe in 1933 And is there any relevance to what's going on now?
That's an excellent question. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you for the call.
Off the air. Thank
sure.
you.
That's actually a fantastic question. I think it bears directly on what we're talking about. Go ahead.
The answer is yes and no, of course. Look, what happened in I can't answer this without talking a little bit about history, obviously. What happened in Germany and what happened in Spain and what happened in Italy were all products of in unequal distribution of goods and services in a capitalist context. But more importantly, World War One, which from the point of view of the U.S. certainly was an unnecessary engagement and horrible with new technologies of destruction and torture, World War One produced an inequitable solution to the question of who would control Africa, who would control all the colonies which shouldn't be controlled, essentially was a fight for control of the seas. It was an incredibly brutal war. It was the first war of its kind, and unfortunately turned out not to be the last. But most importantly,
you mean a fully industrialized, fully mechanized war.
Okay. Totally mechanized war. But beyond that, the settlement of that war forced ruinous conditions upon Germany and other countries, but particularly Germany, which in turn resulted in enormous unemployment, in inflation, in desperation, which led within the traditional limits of sort of democracy in that part of the world, led to the birth of a new movement, nationalist mythologies and hyper racist notions, which is represented easily by Adolf Hitler and his crew. The consequence, and at the same time, a Catholic restoration effort without democratic principles in Spain led to a takeover by Franco, which was a fascist revolution, and a similar kind of thing. I don't want to get into all the details of difference, but a kind of thing like that with Mussolini. Now, when you have, and at the same time, I don't want to ignore this, you have an imperialist nation in Japan, which faced lack of adequate resources to grow in the way that its government and its people thought they ought to be able to. They had already occupied Manchuria. They had already occupied Korea. They were already committing a war, what would be called war crimes, except it wasn't exactly war, for a long, long time. All of this led to a situation where almost inevitably there would be a conflict of an enormous kind. Also, we have to remember that the Soviet Union, now Russia, that the Soviet Union was now established as a giant mega state, and it was engaged in its own kinds of politics. It's really important to see this sudden, terrible situation never be stopped. The notion, for example, of anti-Semitism, which was a popular idea in the United States prior to the Holocaust. I mean, all of these things contribute to a terrible, terrible situation. And in that terrible situation, the opportunities for capital expansion through munitions and other forms becomes even more great. So you have an inevitably horrible situation that develops in these contexts. And the Japanese made the problem simple for us by miscalculating an attack on the United States starting at Pearl Harbor. By the way, our response to that was an incredibly racist and unfair one to Japanese Americans. I mean, we can see unfairnesses and injustices laid upon unfairnesses and injustices, all of it stemming from an incredibly inequitable consequence of the loss that Germany and the Ottoman Empire faced. By the way, the Ottoman Empire was divided up into these lands under the control of France and England for the most part, and the Saudis eventually gained power, which in turn have produced the problems that are common to the Middle East. So you can see that injustice, unfairness, unreasonableness, overambition, capitalist advancement, etc., lead to one war after another.
And I think it's important to point out that the inequitable resolution of the First World War, as you just described it, was only inequitable in terms of the European powers. For those colonial peoples whom they oppressed, it was simply a question of trading one colonial master for
another. Right, you had to learn a new language.
Yeah. Yeah, how to learn a new language. David, daily life with just the same. But I think if we draw in broad strokes, what we've seen since then is simply the expansion, the growth of global capitalism, the inflation of a balloon to fit the size of the earth, as it were. Over since those intervening decades, we've only seen this system extend its tendrils ever farther into more and more nations, tapping the cheap labor of more and more countries, exploiting more and more natural resources. That has not stopped.
Right.
And really, I think that's the overwhelming narrative.
Well, and it's accelerated. And when you may change the players to some degree, but you're not changing the game.
Yeah. Okay. So how does that bear on today, as the caller inquired?
Well, it's a very challenging situation. I mean, I really don't comprehend the degree to which people are misinformed and alienated within the United States itself. And I think we should need to focus in on that.
Right. But I think that what the caller was trying to get at by asking what happened in Europe
in 1933.
How is that analogous or allegorical to what's happening in the United States in
2017? Well, I think I don't think history repeats.
No.
Or to use Marx, history repeats as farce. I mean, that comes from the 18th premier of Louis Napoleon, but never mind. The thing is that what we have now is a world in which the notion of truth is preponderantly based on ignorant notions of ideology. Even, I have to say, and this is a criticism of the resistance as we saw it in Hamburg, even to the extent that there is a notion that if you can fight your way into the streets and win, which proved to be totally untrue in Hitler's Germany and elsewhere, if you can fight in the streets and win and thereby create somehow a revolution without understanding that there has to be full awareness and a full appreciation of the need for social change. That is not part of what happened in Hamburg. That is more, the Hamburg event is more an event in which everybody who's not participating in that behavior, in that dark, I will call it, behavior, is simply an observer to a great pageant of confrontation between fascist police using incredible weaponry against both spontaneous and planned resistance, which includes the destruction of property, and in the course of the fight between the two forces, the police and the Black Bloc, the hurting of a lot of people.
Yeah. To touch on something you said briefly before we get to what happened in Hamburg, I think it's possibly the greatest triumph of capitalist propaganda that they have managed to thoroughly discredit the notion of empirical and rational assessment of the world in favor of, as you said, an ideologically based worldview, of ideologically based reality. It's really quite a staggering achievement.
Well, it is, and it's even more of an achievement in the United States, where you have
right, yeah.
But depending on whose figures, between 30 and 40% of the people believing all kinds of non-truths. And it isn't just political. It's social, it's religious, it's moral. I mean, there really is a push, for example, to limit women's reproductive rights. And that's real. There's really a push to limit the healthcare delivery in general. That's real. All of these things are rooted in non-true models, which have their roots in turn in mythologies that range from Christian fundamentalist beliefs to notions of the special place of the United States in God's heart.
There's a Pew poll from the Pew Corporation that came out this week that shows the majority of registered Republicans in the United States believe that colleges and universities have a negative effect on American culture.
Wait a minute. You mean what is taught has a negative effect?
Yes. Their very existence is detrimental to the health of the nation. A majority of Republicans believe this.
So they would be opposed to state universities?
They would.
They would only have private expensive schools?
But what this really says
is
that a majority of Republicans oppose the idea of higher education and by extension oppose the idea of an objectively empirically determined reality.
Yes.
This is the great triumph of capitalist propaganda that I'm talking
about.
Well,
yeah, and you're talking about it as if it were an inevitable outcome of capitalism. It may or may not be. I'm not sure what that's about exactly, because we have powerful capitalist phenomenon in Germany. The German people are less ignorant than the American people generally. The same is true of France. And I would have said the same is true of Britain until the manipulation of British public opinion to create Brexit.
All right, let's take a call. Charlotte, good morning.
Yeah, hi. You've been very good at answering a lot of the many elements of the relationship between, or not between, 1933 and now, but there are two words that were missing unless I didn't hear them. It's called the Great Depression. And there was a Great Depression then, and people's lives are influenced by the economy and the finances of what's happening in the political economy that they live in all ages. There was a Great Depression in the 30s, and there's a Great Depression now. It's the second worldwide depression. Here, we don't call it a depression now. We call it a Great Recession, but it actually is still a worldwide economic and financial crisis. And I just wanted to mention that because that is a big similarity, and it has a big similarity in the way that people's lives are impacted, that the inequality is greater, people are hurting, people have valid fears and concerns in their lives and also can be manipulated in similar ways in the 1930s and now. That's all I have to say. You might want to carry on with that or keep going and not talk about the comparison between the 1930s.
No, I think, as a matter of fact, I think your call is really germane. I did shortchange the Great Depression, and I think that it is really important to understand this is a bit of a different system.
It is different, but it's actually a worldwide financial and economic crisis that we're not out of yet, that started about 10 years ago almost.
Okay.
So that's been a long time also.
All right, thank you for the call.
Sure, bye.
Okay. Let me talk about this poll I just mentioned for a second.
Okay, let's talk about the poll.
Okay, this is...
By the way, the president went to Poland, which has become an anti-Semitic and vicious country.
Speaking of polls.
All right. Yeah, sorry, bad joke.
All right. So this poll was conducted by the Pew Research Center. It asked the following question. It shows a percentage of people who say each of the following categories has a positive or negative effect on the way things are going in the country. And here are the five categories: churches and religious organizations, banks and financial institutions, labor unions, the national news media, colleges and universities. Now, of all these things, the only one that enjoyed majority support by people self-identify as either Republican or leaning Republican, the only one that enjoyed majority support is churches and religious organizations.
Yes.
Yeah. Banks and financial institutions have more positive support than negative among conservatives, but it doesn't reach above 50%. The rest is all negative. Republicans have a negative view of labor unions, of the national news media overwhelmingly, and as we mentioned, of colleges and universities. The only thing in which there is substantial majority support is churches and religious organizations. What does this mean? This means that a big chunk of the American electorate, it has its fingers in its ears going, la, 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 la.
No, it means, Jesus is coming tomorrow.
It means Jesus is coming tomorrow. This is evidence of a profound dislocation from reality as the majority of people in the world see it. This is a triumph of capitalist propaganda, Joe.
Well,
I'm telling you.
It's beyond the question of capitalism itself. It is a holdout for mystical notions. We see in India, which is, of course, a capitalist country, but we see in India a rising of fundamentalism, not Christian fundamentalism, but Hindu fundamentalism, with vicious consequences. And we see a similar phenomenon among a sector of Muslims all over the world.
Yes, but this just isn't just a holdout for mysticism. This is a whole bunch of things wrapped up. This is religious belief. This is nationalism. This is knee-jerk distrust of labor unions. This is a mistrust, as we mentioned, of education and the benefits that flow from education. This is a willful, enforced ignorance. This is a big chunk of America with their fingers in their ears.
Well, I agree.
Right. So we're asking the question, what should the resistance look like? First and foremost, the resistance needs to concern itself with fact with reality, with pushing back against conservative myth-making.
Well, but from the point of view of those people, reality, as we, you and I, would define it, is simply a crutch without validity. There is no understanding cross-culturally of what is real and what is not. So it's very difficult. I wanted to mention one other thing because it gets short shrift and it shouldn't. The fact of the matter is that through the late 1930s, into the 40s, and into the 50s, and even the 60s, the growth of organized labor was a major force in producing better lives for ordinary people.
Indeed.
That has been deliberately crushed. You talk about capitalism and its role. It has been deliberately crushed by organized capital. And the consequence of that is that we see lower wages. You can look at the two curves. As labor grew in numbers and support, and as it grew in political power, the lives of ordinary people grew better. And as that power in labor was smashed through attacks on the left and so on, many other things, essentially the lives of ordinary people could not keep up with the rising costs of everything. And that is an example of a reactionary force of enormous proportion that is really not discussed or dealt with. Nobody wants to talk about the role of organized labor anymore.
But I do. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that brings us to our second major pillar of what the resistance should look like. The resistance needs to concern itself with people organizing in their own economic, social, and political self-interest.
I agree.
We need to reverse the trend of declining union membership. We need to reverse the trend of declining political participation. And we need to reverse the trend of social isolation that is made so easy by the plethora of entertainment technology that is out there today.
Well, and I think the failed Bernie effort in this election, which initially was a protest movement that he too late realized could actually result in power for the left. I mean, he came to that too late. He was a little bit out of it on questions like Black Lives Matter and so on. But the reality was that had the Democratic Party, this is important, the Democratic Party not stomped out that left movement within the Democratic Party and outside of it, we probably wouldn't be in the bizarre situation we're in with a crazy criminal, literally criminal president of the United States.
Yes, yes. So the first two pillars of our resistance, facts, reason, reality, first. Second, organization, economic, social, political organization on the part of working class people. Let's take some calls and then we'll keep going. Michael, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. So that Pew poll, can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, so that Pew poll about colleges, I know the explanation for that.
What is it?
The explanation for that is that the crazy political correctness that has taken over most colleges
nonsense.
And universities.
Nonsense.
Don't tell me nonsense.
I'm telling you nonsense. Tell me what political correctness means.
Look at what just happened at Evergreen College. Are you aware of what just happened at Evergreen College?
Yes, I'm aware of what happened at Evergreen College.
And telling me that's not crazy political correctness? Students patrolling the campus with baseball bats to intimidate everybody who disagreed with them, ganging up on a professor.
I agree that it's crazy, but I think that the adjective political correctness is meaningless.
I know what it means, even if you don't.
What does it mean? I've been trying to get you to tell me that since you started talking. Go ahead. What does it mean?
Political correctness means the far left being 100% totally intolerant of even the expression of any views that disagree with them. That's what it means. It means, for instance, a field like social psychology, in which something like 95% of the professors in it are far left and actively discriminate against hiring anybody that doesn't share their ideology. It means basically something that's trending towards becoming like the Red Guards were in Maoist China.
Wait a minute. I got to stop you, man. This is absurd. I have spent a career in the educational field, both in management and in teaching, at the community college level and at the university level. And I can tell you, all during that period of time, while there was a consequent war to the Vietnam War and the failure to effectively integrate persons of color and so on, I can tell you that what people were striving for were almost entirely legitimate. How they strove for it, which is what I think you're upset about, is an expression more of reactive frustration than it is about ideology at all. And by when you say left, man, most people have never read Marx, and they're never going to read Marx, and they're not going to read even Mao Zedong. They're not going to read any of this stuff. They're reactive, not initiating new and strong policies, except perhaps in the area of environmental politics.
Well, when you look at, for instance, look at what happened to Charles Murray at Middlebury College.
Charles Murray is a fool with fantastic beliefs. It's not something debatable. There's many, many studies and data that show that he's driven totally by ideology, and in fact that ideology is fundamentally racist.
There is a podcast. Do you know who Sam Harris is?
No.
There is a podcast of Sam Harris's, a very prominent intellectual atheist guy who for the most part has liberal sympathies. He had an interview with Charles Murray that's a podcast that's easy to find that will blow the top of the head off of your ideology if you bother to listen to it.
Okay.
Well, wait. I have to deconstruct a little bit of this. The way in which you're presenting the information is so biased toward your position, it's very hard for me to kind of parse it. If I bother to listen to it as opposed to the stuff I bother to listen to, I mean, come on, man. You're not saying that what I listen to should be exactly what you want me to hear, are you?
I'm just saying, in addition to everything else you listened to, I mean, go back to what I was saying about Middlebury. Whatever you may think of the views of Charles Murray,
yeah,
having students who rioted and injured a professor and refused to allow the guy to speak, even though the professor...
Well, I'm not arguing with you there. I think any kind of mob-based censorship, in fact, any kind of censorship at the university is inappropriate.
That's what I mean by political correctness.
Well, that isn't what... Surely that's not what you mean by political correctness. If you're simply saying anything that doesn't present all the ideas is political correctness, then we are in a culture that is totally politically correct.
Well, when the students and faculty who adhere to this ideology of political correctness also adhere to ideas... and called no platform.
Wait. By your own definition, you're just accusing faculty members of holding to an ideology of censorship. You just equated political correctness with censorship. Are you making a blanket statement that college faculty members are all committed to censorship?
Or are all committed to left-wing thought, for that matter? Because I know, out of my experience, that the ideological diversity that you're concerned about exists at every university I've been involved in. I saw it at Lewis and Clark. I saw it at Clackamas Community College. I saw it at Portland State University. I saw it at the University of Oregon. I saw it at Columbia University. And I saw it at Reed College. So I just can't buy it, man. I can't buy it.
Go to heterodoxacademy.org, HETEROD OX, I guess.
Yeah, heterodoxy,
academy,
right.
.org, where a guy named Jonathan Haidt, who's a liberal social psychologist, has published extensive materials about just how biased humanities departments in colleges are.
There's a problem with that. Yes, there is bias in all fields, and yes, there are popular and unpopular ideas running through all fields. But it is also the case that the overall bias that I have encountered in education is toward fact. It really is.
I think we're going to have to leave it there, Michael. Thank you once again for the call. I want to say just one thing about political correctness before we move on.
Yes.
Generally, when you hear somebody on the right complain about political correctness, what they're really complaining about is that it is no longer fashionable for white men to speak about and treat women and minorities however they please.
I think that is a popular cultural truth.
Yeah. I would agree.
It's very hard to separate these things out, but it's also a last retreat of reactionary thought.
Indeed, and it is true that there has been a deliberate attempt to revise the common parlance, the common use of language, to get rid of terminology that has been historically discriminatory, and the use of which reinforces iniquities, social and economic iniquities. That's why it's not okay to go around saying the N-word anymore. That's why it's not okay to go around referring to women in ways that men often felt comfortable with in the past.
We can't say the word, I don't think, the pee-grabbing Trump thing?
Yeah, that's right. That's what's decried as political correctness by people on the right. They claim that it is censorship, but it is not. You are still free to go out and use the N-word. But I guarantee
go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You are free to do it, but you are not free to escape the consequences of it.
Okay, I agree with that.
All right.
And I also think that you're bringing in a whole other thing. The fact of the matter is that word was used to oppress and to define a whole group of people based on their skin color. Now it is now owned by, and rightly should be owned by, those people of that skin color.
Right.
It's theirs. They didn't want it. They didn't ask for it.
Okay.
But they have the right to own it now.
Okay. Ironically, this brings us to another pillar of the resistance. Resistance needs to be committed to equity, intersectionality, and the advancement of diverse perspectives throughout the social and economic and
political
fabric.
What's intersectionality?
That means, quite simply, there can be no revolution, there can be no resistance, unless we are all lifted together by it.
Oh, okay.
If all the resistance does is put another group of white guys in charge, then we have failed.
Or even, let's say this, another group of persons of color in charge. Or a group, pardon me, that's unfair. A group of persons of color in charge. That's not going to be a solution either.
Yeah.
It's got to be equity, and it's got to be people given opportunity based on their skills and knowledge.
And it's got to be a body politic constituted of a multiplicity of perspectives.
Okay. I think we should go to the phones.
Let's do that.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Well, I'm in Pillar 2. Enough of Pillar 1 and that previous...
I don't think we said all the pillars yet.
Unpacked.
Pardon me.
Organizing. And I know KBU has a wide listenership way beyond the Portland area, so I want to try to speak in local and larger. Organizing politically, there are opportunities to organize. Within the Democratic Party, people have been organizing. County by county, there's change happening. People if are interested in that should look into it. There's other place to organize. I think if we take care of some of the financial structures, like health care for all, and take over our health care system on a local basis and get equity on that, that would be a big part.
Yeah,
the idea great.
Of a state bank. If we could take care of our banking system, there is a movement in the Portland area for a municipal bank. Look at Portland Public Banking Alliance. And but if not, and then organize to take over the elections. The county elections are really important because counties control the jail system in the counties. And if you can operate and control the jail system, that's important. If you can operate and take over the city councils, you have the police, the whole policing bureau, which can be, of course, very oppressive to the resistance. So the main thing is to organize and get involved in some place. So get beyond talk radio when we're done here today and go and find a place to get involved.
Well That's said, my, sir. Absolutely.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that I often will quote, oddly enough, my favorite anarchist Catholic friend, now gone, who essentially said that the worst sin is the sin of despair. That's when you go, it's all going to be, we're going to hell in a basket, and then you just don't struggle. And I think that is a serious existential and real problem in this culture, where good people, many of them well-educated and some of them not so well-educated, simply give up and say they're all crooks.
Hey, listen, thank you very much for the call. Let's take care of a little biz here, and we'll continue with our conversation. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, in an alternative radio classic, Dr. Cornel West recounts the history of radical democratic traditions during a visit to Portland in 1995.
I like Cornel West a lot.
Well, you can hear him at 9 o'clock on KBOO.
Well, I probably will listen.
At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio presents a radio documentary by Demay Roberts, Secret Asian Woman, tells the stories of mixed-race Asian-American women with identities not easily recognized by the general public. And at 11:30, Art Focus brings you Yellow Terror, the paintings of Roger Shimomura. All this and more coming up today on your...
Shimomura Moore is very good.
Yes, he is.
I realized I didn't mention the name of that woman who was so influential to me in the Catholic community, Dorothy Day, who will someday, I predict, be made a saint. Not that I care.
All right. So far we've gone through three of the pillars of the resistance. One, a reinvigoration of reason, empiricism, and reality into the public discourse. Two, organization amongst working people in all spheres of life, economic, social, political. Three, a commitment to diversity and equity for everybody. The revolution needs to undo the resistance. Ooh, I had a Freudian slip there. Resistance needs to undo the centuries of racism and discrimination and systematic oppression of non-majority peoples. And that brings us to number four, sustainability. Whatever we do, we need to figure out how to put the brakes on global warming. And lest anyone be confused, global warming is a direct function of global capitalism and the fact that global capitalism runs on combustion as a source of energy. We need to put the brakes on that.
Okay.
Yeah, are you on board with that?
Oh, yeah.
And we could do that in...
I like all four pillars.
You like all four pillars so far?
I'm a pillar guy.
You're a pillar guy. Okay. So we're getting towards the end of the show. So let me get to our fifth pillar and then we'll...
Oh, yes. Hurry, hurry, hurry.
All right. And this one we've saved till last because it's been a source of some controversy here in Portland, obviously in Hamburg, and probably in cities around the world. And that is nonviolence. The resistance must be nonviolent, period. No exceptions. What happened in Hamburg is a larger scale reenactment of what happened here in Portland several weeks ago. We saw large nonviolent gatherings of people that were spoiled by a small group of black-clad so-called anti-fascists who decided that they were going to use violence to express their political discontent.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
No?
Yeah. I think it's a little more complex than that, number one. Number two, I think the police used the excuse of these attackers to the degree, and I was in that thing, at least on the May Day one. I wasn't at the other one. My understanding is really there are a few jerks who do a bunch of jerky things, and if it takes getting them arrested, so be it. More important, though, was the incredible number, in May Day at least, of families, of persons of color, of Hispanics, of all kinds of people, labor people and so on, who were legitimately expressing their beliefs. And the police used the fact of the black bloc to end a parade that was essentially peaceful. And I want to add one other thing. I'm beginning to think that people should give up the process of getting police permits for parades at all.
Yeah, agreed. I think that the police...
The state doesn't get to decide if you can have a demonstration.
I completely agree. I completely agree. But I also stand by what I said.
Yeah.
We have to be nonviolent.
No, I agree. And the overarching strategy, as well as the moral imperative, it makes more sense to follow Gandhi and Martin Luther King than it does any other procedure. Just on practical terms, we ain't got the nuclear weapons. We ain't got the regular guns.
No.
We don't have any of the weapons that would allow a violent revolution. And we don't have the support of enough people. We haven't convinced them enough. So the thing that has to happen is it really is putting bodies on the line. It means people are going to get bashed by police. It means there's going to be some kinds of really ugly behaviors. But it must be fundamentally clean, clear, moral behavior.
Absolutely. If anybody is going to be violent, let it be the oppressors. Let it be seen by everyone that they are using violence to maintain their position of privilege and power.
Well, it's hard to be nonviolent when somebody's hitting you with a water cannon, I have to say.
Indeed it is, but you can resolve not to start the fight.
Yes.
Listen, you know, I've seen it happen many times. You've seen it happen many times. A peaceful protest is ruined by a small group of people who can't keep it in their pants, for lack of a better term.
Excuse
who think
me?
They need to lob a brick through a Starbucks window. You don't need to do that. And every time you do that, the message is lost. The thrust of your effort is blunted. It is, you're ruining it for everybody. This happened in Hamburg. I know somebody there. I know somebody who shot video of this happening. I know somebody who was part of a peaceful protest, but she felt compelled to leave because violence was instigated by black-clad Antifa.
There's also another factor in this, which is it sets things up for agent provocateur.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm not trying to let the police off the hook here. As you mentioned, I think they have a very deliberate and very nefarious role in the violence that breaks out at these
Ultimately, in the structure of power, they are the enforcers for the controlling interests of the society.
You are absolutely correct, which in my mind only reinforces the need for the resistance to be nonviolent.
Well, I agree with you, and I also know that that's very hard to do. That sitting down in the face of powerful forces who are willing to do you violence is very difficult. There were many people actually in Hamburg who tried that.
Yes,
and they got literally swept away by the water cannons.
Yes, they did. Yeah, you're correct, and we need to acknowledge that complexity.
Well, and it's going to become more and more difficult as the technology of crowd control grows. We already have in Portland these, haven't been used much, these giant loudspeakers that make it impossible to think and hurt you in the ears.
Yes.
And we already are seeing flashbang grenades. We're seeing the use of chemical weapons by the police. We are seeing so-called less lethal weapons. It's a very, very, it's a very bad path toward militarization, which... I see no limit on because people get scared and upset when they can't get home from work.
All right, let's go to the phones. Sunny, good morning.
Good morning. These are all really important, interesting things to think about. You guys have really put your thinking caps on. This is really invigorating.
Thank you.
Well, it's more his fault than mine.
Oh.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I would say that whenever Hillary Clinton opens her mouth and says, "I am the resistance," well, then, I don't know, you might want to have a different word.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to deconstruct the notion that Hillary is the great feminist woman. She is a woman. She is a good person in many ways. She probably would have been a more rational president, for sure. But since her husband's presidency, we have seen the Democratic Party reduce its left-wing powers and move away from the support of working people and essentially isolate itself into a much more elite body. And that has been very destructive for good politics in America.
Let's remember how viciously and truly viciously Clinton went after lower-income people. And that's basically something welfare reform has really... How many people... has welfare put out on the welfare reform put out on the streets, and then what happens? Those people disappear. Also, let's remember that when he decided that China needed all of our jobs and that would bring them to democracy, he sent all the work over there, most of it for working class people, and then the drugs replaced it, and they have devastated this country.
Well, I don't disagree with your overall view of the dilemmas of Clinton, President
they've
Clinton.
They've been nightmares
created.
For this country to tell
you
the
but
truth.
I think the forces involved are more complex than you're suggesting.
Yes, but that's Trump can hardly be worse than what Clinton and them did.
Oh, yes, he can.
No, okay, I overstated there, but you know what? As a working class person, and the millions and millions and millions. And the drugs that have come instead, 14,000 needles they cleared off the Spring Hill Corridor path in 3 days of cleanup because so many people are devastated. And that does not mean that all the homeless people are out there because of drugs. But once the people go into drugs, their lives are almost entirely lost, and their lives are tortured until they're lost. It's terrible. It's terrible how they have betrayed this country. And I'd say a radical facet of the future or the present right now is consideration and cooperation. And get the water supplies up and start your victory gardens and think positive. Because Clinton also had the opportunity to perhaps, you know, blow up North Korea's little weapons factory before it really got going. but none of them did. And now we all get to look at it.
Well, you're I think what you're saying is interesting, but you're mixing apples and oranges.
Well,
and now you've introduced another element, which is the question of what kind of an imperialist response should we have to a nation that's building the kind of weapons we have.
Well, all we can have right now, I'd say, is everybody better start storing up a lot of water and getting food supplies, because something will come out of this. And we don't even know what direction it's going to come out of it, because now, you know, it used to be keep everybody busy with sex, drugs, rock and roll, and food. And now it's keep everybody busy with fear and violence and chaos and disaster.
Yeah, I'd rather have the sex, drugs, rock and roll, and food.
Yeah, so honestly, I'd say cooperation and consideration is really radical.
Okay, I want to... I'll
let it go.
Okay,
bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Susan writes into the Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe, to say, I always enjoy caller Michael's comments. He is considered and thoughtful in his offerings. However, I take issue in his remarks today with regard to universities and the reasons for their disparagement among those on the right. I was a faculty member teaching nursing for 30 years at a state university. Partisanship was simply not an issue, ever. Healthcare of those who are ill is neither left nor right, but simply a moral obligation. Promoting health and preventing illness and disability is likewise a non-political endeavor. To be sure, when universities are criticized, there are disciplines which are deserving of said examination. However, there are many, nursing and chemistry, for example, which engage in student learning in a spectacularly non-political manner. In fact, to teach any differently is not only inappropriate and unprofessional, it is unethical.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that one of the things I've discovered in teaching, because I teach in the social sciences, that is history and sociology, that a lot of bias, a lot of misunderstanding actually is inculcated in our culture, in our people. And I have to say, much of it has its roots in oddly fundamentalist beliefs. And we don't do this, but I actually could be lecturing about what role the fundamentalist movements in America took in creating the idea of America's specialness. Anyway.
Mark writes in to say, Dostoevsky warned that people would surrender their freedom to the Grand Inquisitor for his promise of happiness. Did people think Trump represented a strong man because he fired people on his apprentice show from 2004 to 2015?
Yes.
Resistance is part of our nature, as antibodies are part of our bodies. We must encourage resistance amid a corporate-dominated culture that normalizes narcissism, hypocrisy, and Orwellian doublespeak.
I absolutely agree.
Yes. Telling the truth is a revolutionary act, Orwell said. If we don't resist, college graduates will choose between the tax avoidance industry and driving cars for Uber.
As a matter of fact, the old anti-ban-the-bomb, anti-war community, which grew quite significant and to some degree probably forestalled a Cold War, not a Cold War, but a Cold War turning into a hot war. That movement had at its root ideas of Christian pacifism and of Quakerism, speaking truth to power.
Yes. Let's go back to the phones. George, good morning.
Abe and Joe, three factors that one of them has already been mentioned by your last caller about the migration of industry and jobs to other places like China. Three factors. One, something Joe brought up, and I think you may have, the parallel, or what apparently is a parallel, between the brown shirts in 1933 and the Antifa movement in Hamburg. That's the way I see it, anyway.
Well, I don't quite buy that, but okay.
Just a second. That the brown shirts were deliberately whipped up from working class people to provide a veneer of apparent validity to Hitler's movement. And one could say that some of these black bloc people may be being used in the same way as the brown shirts to tie up something to the ordinary working class people and connect the establishment's control to, what's the word, disappear it behind a mask of we have some real popular movement. That's the first thing. The second thing, the labor movements in different parts of the world, in Europe, in the U.S., for example, have been finessed, of course, as one of the callers mentioned, by jobs going elsewhere. And this was no accident. It was planned long and long ago. And the satellites and other technology made it possible to build factories in any part of the world from downtown Manhattan and put the jobs elsewhere. A third factor, of course, is the Democratic Party didn't just 10 or 15 years ago decide to go to big business. There were books appearing in the 1970s about the Democratic Party undergoing a deep shift and going begging to big corporations for money and abandoning its block, or its own voters. And I think these things were all connected, and you guys are terrific because you're talking about the complex, numerous factors, and they're
well, I appreciate that, but we're literally out of time, and I did want to make one quick comment.
Thank you. That's a great call. Go
ahead. Yeah, very good call. I think a very good show, actually, he says of his show. But, you know, I really think it is important that we make, all of us, make a more detailed, more rational study of history and the social sciences. And I really think also that one has to be careful in choosing sources. They need to be fact-based. And they can be biased, but they need to be fact-based.
Agreed. Agreed. This was an excellent conversation. An hour is far too little time.
Yeah. To really give us more this. And pay us more. Oh, wait. We never paid at all.
All right. But to sum up, here are the five pillars of our
real
resistance.
Quick.
Reason, rationality, fact, organization, diversity and equity, sustainability, and nonviolence. That's what the resistance needs to look like.
Okay.
All right. We'll be back at you next week.
And remember, it's the best in music anywhere in the Portland area. That's K-Boob.
Democracy is coming to the USA.
Good morning, KBOO listeners. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It is 9 o'clock, and up next is Alternative Radio. It is it's a special day here at KBOO. It's a beautiful day in Portland, and it's not too hot, and it's not too cold, and it's not wet, and I wish you just a wonderful morning. I'm Tave Fache-Drake, and I'm going to be here with you until noon today. So again, up next, in just a few moments after these messages, Alternative Radio. It's a classic. Dr. Cornel West recounts the history of radical democratic traditions during a visit to Portland in 1995. And then at 10, we have Air Cascadia. It's headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Stage and Studio presents a radio documentary by Dime Roberts, Secret Asian Woman. And it tells the story of mixed race Asian American women.